last time I talked a little bit about perturbation theory, and I sort of defined it. I gave you some simple examples. I was going to talk about summing perturbation series this morning. But actually, as I was walking in, I decided I would talk about something else and leave that until tomorrow or something. Just see how that works. I want to give you some more examples of perturbation expansions because I think they're fun. And then I want to explain to you why it is that that perturbation theory, why a perturbation series actually has to diverge. I mean, what is it physically that causes a perturbation series to diverge? And I thought we would look at the physics of it as well as the mathematics of it. But let me remind you what I said. I said that a perturbation series can either converge or diverge, depending on whether the value of epsilon that you choose is inside the radius of convergence or outside the radius of convergence. And what I said was that there are two types of perturbation theory. There's the easy type, which is a regular perturbation series. So we said we have a regular perturbation series. And remember, the definition, this is a little bit vague, okay? But a regular perturbation series is one where, in the limit as epsilon goes to 0, nothing nothing abrupt happens as epsilon goes to 0. Okay? And that's a vague, I'm explaining this to you in vague terms, but that's sort of the idea. That's a regular perturbation theory. In a singular perturbation theory, the opposite happens. Something abrupt happens. Some abrupt change occurs at epsilon equals 0. Okay? And we saw that, just to make sense of this, what we said was, for example, if you're trying to solve the problem x to the 5 plus x equals 1, using perturbation theory, in this case, where we are doing what I was calling strong coupling perturbation theory, when you try to solve a problem like this, okay, there is no abrupt change at epsilon equals 0. Whereas over here, when you're doing weak coupling perturbation theory, there is an abrupt change. And it's pretty obvious that there's an abrupt change, because when epsilon is equal to 0, 4 of the roots disappear. And in fact, we could ask the following question. We could say, in this case, where did the roots go? Do you know where they went? Does anybody have an idea? Where did the 4 roots go? They went somewhere. That's one possibility. So one possibility is that the roots could all become degenerate. Okay, but that is actually not what happened. In many cases, you could be right. But in this case, it didn't happen. So it would be interesting, I thought, just to spend a minute or two and figure out where, in this case, where did the roots go? I mean, it's pretty strange to say all of a sudden, psh, there are no more roots. Where did they go? Well, let's examine this equation for small epsilon, okay? And to study this equation for small epsilon, what we're going to do is a standard technique that you use in asymptotics called dominant balance. Okay? So when epsilon becomes very small, the question is, there are three terms in this equation, and there's an equality. Okay? So typically, when epsilon becomes very small, two terms are roughly the same size, and they balance. And the third term is usually negligible. Now, it could be that all three terms are of exactly the same size. But that can't be. Okay? Because if all of the terms were exactly the same size, you can see that there's a contradiction. Imagine that all three terms were exactly the same size for very small epsilon. Okay, if that were true, then x would be about the same size as 1. X would be of order 1. But if x is of order 1, x to the fifth is of order 1. But it's multiplied by epsilon. Contradiction. Okay, so they can't all be the same size. Okay? So there are three possibilities. Either x is of order 1, and epsilon x to the 5 is negligible. That's one possibility. Or, and when I say negligible, I mean small compared with 1. Negligible. Okay? That's one possibility, 1. Second possibility is this term here is about the same size as that, and x is negligible. So it could be that epsilon x to the 5 is approximately 1, and x is negligible. Okay. Or the third possibility is that epsilon x to the 5 is approximately the same size as minus x, and 1 is negligible. So those are the possibilities. Okay. So look at the first one. Is this a possible result? Could it be that x is about the same size as 1, but epsilon x to the 5 is negligible? Of course. That's consistent. Right? That's perfectly consistent. In fact, that's the case we looked at. That's precisely the case we looked at. Okay? So yes, this is okay, and that gives us one root out of the 5. That's the root that we studied. Okay? So indeed, this is what we did yesterday. Okay? What about this? Is it possible for epsilon x to the 5 to be about the same size as 1 and x to be negligible? Okay, compared to these two terms. Okay? So let's check that. If we look at this case, if epsilon x to the 5 is approximately 1, then x to the 5 is approximately 1 over epsilon. Okay? So x is approximately 1 over epsilon to the 1/5, okay, times 1 of the fifth roots of 1. Okay, you all understand there are 5 possible, you've had some complex variables, right? You did some complex variables. So x could be the same, could be of order 1 over epsilon to the 1/5, let's say, times omega, okay, where omega is 1 of the fifth roots of 1, you know, where omega to the 5 equals 1. Okay? Are you all following the logic here? Okay, but if this balances this, then it's x that has to be negligible. Okay? And x has to be negligible compared with this term and this term. So this is called the method of dominant balance. We're looking for a dominant balance between this term and this term where x is negligible. But x, we just said, is of order 1 over epsilon to the 1/5. So it would have to be that omega over epsilon to the 1/5 would be negligible compared with 1. That's not true. That's a contradiction, right? Because as epsilon goes to 0, this is going to infinity. This is getting very, very big. And this is 1. So that's an impossible dominant balance. Okay? So we have one more dominant balance. We're asking here under number 3, could it be that epsilon x to the 5 is asymptotic to minus x? Okay, if that's a possibility, then let's see what this says. This says that, of course, we can divide by x, so it says epsilon x to the 4 is approximately minus 1, or x to the 4 is approximately minus 1 over epsilon, okay, or x is approximately minus 1 over epsilon to the 1 quarter, okay, 1 over epsilon to the minus 1 quarter times omega, or let's take away the minus sign, times omega, where omega to the 4th equals minus 1. Okay, so there are four roots of minus 1. Okay, you all know that. There are four roots of minus 1. And omega is one of those four roots. Okay? Now the question is this a consistent dominant balance? Is that a consistent dominant balance? Well, the question is, in number 3, the number 1 had to be negligible compared with the two terms that we kept. Is that consistent? Is it consistent to say that 1 is negligible compared with, say, minus x or epsilon x to the 5? Okay, do you all see that? Okay, and that's clearly true. This is correct. So we have found four more roots. Okay, and in fact, what is the fourth root of minus 1? Remember, minus 1 is equal to e to the I pi. So minus 1 to the 1 quarter is equal to e to the I pi over 4. Okay, that's one possibility. But minus 1 is also equal to e to the I pi plus 2n I pi. Okay, so this is e to the I pi over 4 plus 1 half n I pi. Okay, so n in this case could be 0 or 1 or 2 or 3. Okay, and those are the fourth roots of minus 1. Okay, and so where did the roots go as epsilon goes to 0? Where do they go? Where do they go? Off to infinity. That's right. And in fact, we know how they go off to infinity because we have an approximate picture of them. We know that one of the roots stabilizes over here at 1 as epsilon goes to 0. And the other four roots go off to infinity at in like this. One root goes to the southwest and one root goes to the northwest and one to the northeast and one to the southeast. Okay, so that's where the roots are going. So this looks bad because, you see, if we wanted to calculate the other four roots, we were able to get the real root that stabilized at 1. But what about the other four roots? And this would be a good problem as an exercise problem. How do we calculate the other four roots? An interesting question. So, what do you suggest? How about making a substitution? Okay? How about something like this? How about saying, since we know where the roots go, where these roots are going, why don't we say let y? We know that the other four roots are complex. Let's let x here, since x is of order 1 over epsilon to the 1 quarter times something or other. Let's let, say, x equal y over epsilon to the 1 quarter. That seems like an interesting substitution. Okay. So remember, x is going off to infinity. But y is now going to stabilize. Okay. Do you all see that? So I'm incorporating that. So if I make this substitution, and I substitute it into this equation, how does it read? It reads epsilon y to the 5th over epsilon to the 5/4 plus x, which is y over epsilon to the 1/4, equals 1. And you notice that when I cancel this epsilon here, the 5 becomes a 1. I multiply by epsilon to the 1/4, and something very interesting happens. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this is that you already suggested doing something like this. One of you, I forgot who suggested it last time. Okay, if you multiply by epsilon to the 1/4, you get the equation y to the 5 plus y equals epsilon to the 1/4. Now, do you remember that, who suggested last time, couldn't we put an epsilon over here on the right-hand side of the equation? I forgot. So was it you who suggested it? I saw somebody who suggested it. Okay. So you're not willing to admit it, I guess. All right. What's that? Oh, he's not here. Oh, all right. That's embarrassing for him. All right. So you see what's happened here. The natural small parameter in this problem is not epsilon. It's epsilon to the 1/4. And this perturbation theory is a regular perturbation theory. Why is that? Because as epsilon goes to 0, all 5 roots remain. So do you see that we have converted a singular perturbation problem into a regular perturbation problem, where the natural small parameter is epsilon to the 1/4? And now if we develop a perturbation series for any of the 5 roots, any of them, that perturbation series for y will have the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n, epsilon to the 1/4 to the n, epsilon to the n over 4. Do you see? This perturbation series is not a series in powers of epsilon, but a series in powers of epsilon to the 1/4. That's very, very natural. Okay? We won't say a word. Not a word. Okay? So that's the natural perturbation series, and it's a very peculiar looking perturbation series because it's not a series in powers of epsilon. You might not have guessed right away that the natural small parameter is epsilon to the 1/4. Okay? And you were asking about perturbation series that are not series in powers of epsilon. This is an example of one. Okay? Very natural perturbation series. Of course, this is the perturbation series for y. The perturbation series for x has the form x is 1 over epsilon to the 1/4, right, just substituting back, times a sub n, epsilon to the n over 4. And you know what's going to happen if this is a sum from n equals 0 to infinity. And you know what's going to happen when you look for roots of this form. You know perfectly well what's going to happen. For the root that we were talking about yesterday, what's going to happen is that the first term in this series is 0. And then an epsilon to the 1/4 will divide out. And then what will happen is that there will be one non-zero term, and then 3 zero terms, and then one non-zero term, and then 3 zero terms, and so on. And this perturbation series will reduce to the regular perturbation series that we know and love from this calculation. Okay? Yeah, you have a question.
When you say this is epsilon to the 1/4, mm-hmm. can we just say it's not prime equal epsilon to the 1/4?
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. I mean, that's the thing that is small, that we're treating as small. Of course, at the end of the calculation, we're going to be setting this guy equal to 1. Okay? So it is possible in some rare cases to convert a regular perturbation problem into a singular perturbation problem, or back again. We may be able to change back and forth. Do you understand what's happening here? Any questions about that? There's an example that that you know about that I thought I would mention. And this is a very, very famous example. This is the Wilkinson polynomial. And this is really fun. Wilkinson is, I don't think he's not alive anymore, but he was a very clever numerical analyst, okay? And he suggested the following perturbation problem, okay? Just the way we were calculating roots of polynomials, he suggested that we look at the following polynomial. Maybe we should call it W for Wilkinson, okay? So his polynomial was x minus 1 times x minus 2 times x minus 3 times x minus 4 all the way up to x minus 20. Okay, and he said, can you find the roots of this polynomial? Just kidding. Okay, I'm just kidding. It's just a little bit more complicated than that. He said, plus x to the 19th. Okay, so, so of course, you don't have a formula for solving a 20th degree polynomial. Okay, if that stupid x to the 19th weren't there, of course, you could find the roots of the polynomial. And this is crying out. It's screaming at you. It's saying, use perturbation theory. Insert an epsilon. Now, if you walk up to an average guy who was just walking down the street and you said, could you solve the problem, where would that guy suggest putting the epsilon? Absolutely. Okay. This is a gimme, right? So we're going to insert an epsilon right over there. Now I have to ask you, is this going to be a regular perturbation problem or a singular perturbation problem? Okay, so remember, in a singular perturbation problem, the perturbation series is typically not in the form of a Taylor series. You can see, this is not a Taylor series, because it's a series in fractional powers of epsilon, not integer powers of epsilon, and also because there's a 1 over epsilon out front. Okay, and so in a singular perturbation series, it's not Taylor-like. In this case, this is a regular perturbation problem. Why? Because in the limit as epsilon goes to 0, you still have all 20 roots. And therefore, you can do 20 different perturbation expansions, right? You can solve for root number, what's your favorite root? 14. Okay? So if you wanted to find x14 as a function of epsilon, you would seek a perturbation series of the form 14, that's the solution when epsilon equals 0, right? Plus a epsilon plus b epsilon squared. And we can be sure this is a Taylor-like series because this is a regular perturbation problem. We don't lose any roots in the limit as epsilon goes to 0. Is that clear? Okay, so this is an obvious problem. Now, all right, great. Is there any, so this is a routine problem, right? Well, amazingly, this is not a routine problem. This is definitely not a routine problem. The question is this. If we work out, suppose we were to calculate, just for fun, the 19th root. Okay, so it would, this perturbation series would have this form. The question is, how big do you think epsilon has to be before you are outside the radius of convergence? We know that the series is going to be a formal Taylor series, and it's going to be a Taylor series with a finite, non-zero radius of convergence. We know that. But the question is, how big can epsilon be before this becomes a divergent series? That's the question. So how would you make an estimate? Well, if you were using, can somebody come up with an argument? I mean, how big would you want epsilon to be before something bad might happen? I mean, how would you make an estimate here? Very good. I was hoping somebody would say that. And you did. Good. Okay? And that's what you said is a very clear, natural question to ask. I mean, the question is, how big is this coefficient of epsilon to the 19th compared with the coefficient of epsilon to the 19th over there? Right? So what is, if we were to multiply this out, the first term in the polynomial, of course, would be x to the 20. And the next term would be x to the 19th, times minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, minus 20, right? Okay? Plus this epsilon, well, let's put here, plus epsilon, Okay? And the question is, how big, what is this number? What is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus up to 20? You know the Gauss story. Say it again. Okay, good. Okay, that you remember the famous story where Gauss was asked to stay after school because he had been a bad boy, and he had to add up all the numbers from 1 to 100, so he wrote it down immediately and got up and walked out. Okay, so he knew how to sum an arithmetic series when he was a little boy. Okay, so it's 210 plus epsilon. Okay, so you can see that this term must be important if it's bigger than, say, 210. But you wouldn't think that there would be any problem if epsilon, for example, were of order 1, because it would only be a half a percent change. Remember that, only half a percent change compared with the number 210. Do you all agree? That is the natural thing to say. But you know why I'm raising this issue, because it turns out not to be true. In fact, what actually happens is this. If you make a plot, so this is the x-axis, and when epsilon is equal to 0, the roots are at 1, 2, 3, these are the roots all the way up to 20. Okay? And there's a root at 19, and here there's a root at 18, and so on. Now, the question is, what happens to the roots as epsilon gets bigger? It's very interesting. As epsilon begins to get bigger, this root begins to move downward, and this root begins to move upward. Okay? And eventually, at some point, these two roots become degenerate. Okay? And then they move off into the complex plane. Okay? Now, and then the next two roots, these roots move down where they move toward each other and they become degenerate and they move off into the complex plane. Now, when the roots move off into the complex plane, they become complex numbers. But as you can see from yesterday, the perturbation coefficients will all be real numbers. So it's clear that this perturbation series that you would develop, a series in powers of epsilon, cannot give the correct answer because the roots are complex and the perturbation series coefficients are real. So it's not giving the right answer. So we must be outside the radius of convergence of the perturbation theory. So the question is, how big does epsilon have to be before these roots combine? As soon as these roots become degenerate, that is the radius of convergence of the perturbation series. The perturbation series can only converge, so this series of the form a sub n epsilon to the n, okay, can only converge if epsilon is less than some radius of convergence r. And when you reach this radius of convergence, that's when these two roots become degenerate. The question is, how big is that? Well, your estimate would be on the order of maybe 1% of this or some number like that. Well, it isn't 1. It's about 10 to the minus 9, which is incredible. And you say, where did that come from? I knew you'd say that. And there's an important lesson to be learned. Sometimes, even if you're dealing with a regular perturbation series, you have to learn how to sum the series when, even if you have a regular perturbation series, because you're outside the radius of convergence of that perturbation series. That's motivation for what this course is going to be about, how to sum a series. But there's a very important lesson to be learned here. And can any of you see what the real lesson is that is being taught here? Never mind perturbation theory. It's a bigger lesson than that. Well, yes, that's it. Well, your intuition is going to get better and better, and eventually it'll be trustworthy. But the point is, when you are doing numerical calculations, you have to be extremely careful because a numerical calculation is like a sausage. Okay? It seems to work just fine until you find out what went into it. Okay? The point is, if you were on a computer trying to find the roots of this polynomial, and you were doing it in single precision, if you were actually doing it in single precision, then the coefficients of this polynomial would be correct only up to 8 decimal places. But if the coefficients were determined, if you were putting these coefficients into your computer program, accurate to 8 decimal places, the roots that you're getting are complete junk. Because small perturbations of these coefficients cause major changes in the roots. You notice, if the size of epsilon is as big as 10 to the minus 9, by now the roots are no longer, these roots over here are no longer real. They have moved toward each other and they've moved off into the complex plane. And the error that you're calculating in the roots is immense. In fact, your computer doesn't even realize that the roots are complex, or may not realize that the roots are complex. This is a very, very serious point that Wilkinson is making. So finding the roots of polynomials is a very, very, very subtle thing to do if you're doing on a computer. Okay? Of course, if it's a third-degree polynomial or a fourth-degree polynomial, there's no such problem. Okay? But by the time you get up to a 20th-degree polynomial, it could be a disaster. Yeah, yeah.
How do we see that the roots move off to the complex plane?
It's not an easy argument to give.
I see.
Okay? Okay, so you can formulate an argument. What you have to do is you have to look at all of these coefficients, all of the coefficients, and ask, and you have to do a dominant balance argument. Okay, you have to say for small epsilon, which are the important numbers here? And the comparison, you know, what we did was what we thought naturally we should do is to compare the size of this x to the 19th term with this term, the minus 210, and that's not the correct comparison here. So you have to look for a dominant balance argument and follow through it. And I won't go further on that because you could look at that. But there's an important lesson to be learned. And relevant to perturbation theory, the important lesson is if you're doing a perturbative calculation, you may be getting an answer which is, if you don't know how to sum a series, you may be wasting your time because you may be way outside the radius of convergence. Here, when we set epsilon equal to 1, we're 1 billion times bigger than the radius of convergence, which is amazing. Okay? Absolutely amazing. All right.
Is this sort of generally true of all higher order polynomials, or is this just a very...
He constructed this, okay? So some high-degree polynomials are well-conditioned, well-behaved. This is actually a problem that goes beyond polynomials. It has to do with matrix multiplications, handling big matrices, big matrix operations. Whenever you're handling a lot of numbers, sometimes things can become very, very cumbersome and very, very complicated, and you may have to go to multiple precision before you can believe your numerical calculation. Okay? So don't just program in Fortran or C or something and just walk away from it saying, you know, we can do this in single precision. You've got to be really, really cautious. So numerical analysis is not a trivial subject, and we can see this from the point of view of perturbation theory. Okay? But now, what I would like to do is to explain in physical terms, because this is almost never done, why it is that perturbation theory, why a perturbation series can be divergent. Okay? And this is a really interesting topic. And so let's take a model that we can study. This is a favorite model of mine, okay? Let's look at a simple quantum mechanics problem, okay? The simple quantum mechanics problem, let's look at the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Okay? This is called, well, first of all, if I take this term away, what does this Schrödinger equation describe? Say it again.
Harmonic oscillator.
Okay, just checking. Okay, so that's the harmonic oscillator. Okay, this is the time-independent Schrödinger equation for the anharmonic oscillator. Okay, this is called, this term x to the 4 is an anharmonic term. And nobody knows how to solve this differential equation exactly. So this is an example of a very hard problem. Okay, so we can't solve that. So we would like to solve this equation using perturbation theory. So I need a suggestion from you. Where would you like to put a small parameter? Say it again. Put a small parameter in front of x to the 4. I completely agree. Okay. Now, we have to talk about that. We have to talk about that. Why do we want to put it there? Right. Because we know the solution when epsilon equals 0. So this is a natural place. Okay. Now, you have studied, all of you have studied a little bit of quantum field theory. And what I'm telling you about, the reason for understanding this problem, is that this goes right to quantum field theory. You have studied quantum field theory, Hamiltonians of the form grad phi squared, and you probably like to write a 2, plus phi squared, and maybe there's an m squared over 2, plus g phi to the 4. Okay? So this is a simple model of a quantum field theory problem, okay? Except it's at the level of quantum mechanics, and you're going to understand the quantum field theory that you've been studying much, much better after we get done with this discussion, okay? So this is, I completely agree with you, this is the natural place for a small perturbation parameter. But the question is this perturbation theory that we're going to be doing a regular perturbation theory or a singular perturbation theory? And that's a hard question. Does anybody see the answer to that? Is this a regular perturbation problem or a singular perturbation problem?
You said
singular.
Okay. Now, first of all, I'm sure you're very good at gamespersonship. Okay, and you remember that I said last time that essentially all interesting physical problems are singular perturbation problems. Okay, but why do you say that this is? Can you give an argument for why this is a singular? You're absolutely right, by the way. You're completely correct. But why is it a singular perturbation problem? Because it's not obvious.
Well, like, it's power.
Yes. We need a better, can you give them more?
This is because you go from one, you have the vacuum, and then your particular potential gets to low energy states.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so your argument goes like this. If epsilon is positive, okay, and we plot the potential V of X, this is V of X. If epsilon is positive, the potential looks like this. If epsilon is negative, no matter how small, the potential looks like, no, it looks like, if epsilon is negative.
Negative, yes.
Aha, okay, good. It looks like this. For sufficiently small, for sufficiently large x, x to the fourth eventually becomes more important than x squared, and therefore the potential goes like this. Now, in case one, we have energy levels which are over here. You all understand? Case one, this is where the energy levels are. Okay? And there's a ground state in the system. Okay? Whereas in case two, here's the ground state. Right? Well, okay, you're shaking your head. No. Why no?
Because the ground state doesn't exist.
The ground state doesn't exist. That's right. In fact, none of these states exist. Why? Because if I put a particle in this well, it tunnels out and goes off to infinity.
And so we don't have a time-independent situation. There's no ground state. So there is no question that there's an abrupt change that happens at epsilon equals 0. So therefore, this is truly a singular perturbation problem. So we've been forced into it. OK, now I know what you're thinking. Maybe we could put epsilon somewhere else. OK? So this is called a weak coupling expansion. And this is what is used to develop Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory. But we could do a strong coupling expansion. We did very well with a strong coupling expansion before. We could maybe put epsilon over here. OK? So just the way we put an epsilon when we were solving here, we put an epsilon in front of the term with the smaller power of x, we had a convergent perturbation series, and that was a regular perturbation problem. So we could put the epsilon over here. There's only one problem. OK, what's the problem? Now I should ask you. I'm putting you on the spot. What's the problem? That's right. The problem is we can't solve. So let me write over here. OK, $5,000 reward if you can solve the following problem. OK, I would love to know the solution to this problem. I can't prove that you can't solve this problem, but no one has ever been able to do so. If you could solve that problem, then now we would be very happy puppies, because you would be able to, this is the epsilon equals 0, this is the epsilon equals 0, the unperturbed problem that we would have to solve in order to do strong coupling theory. But nobody knows how to solve that problem. Now, we do know how to solve, in this case, we do know how to do a weak coupling perturbation expansion. But we expect that this perturbation expansion is going to be singular. That's the problem. OK? So let me show you what the perturbation series, first of all, I haven't yet told you how to develop this perturbation series. And I'll tell you, if we have time, how to do it. But I want to tell you the consequences of doing it. Okay? So first of all, let's put in some numbers here. I'm going to put in, these are my favorite numbers, but it doesn't have to be. Okay? I just like those numbers. But so for the ground state, we expect to have a series of the ground state energy will be a series in powers of epsilon. Okay. Now, do any of you know the first term? Or maybe you don't like these numbers. Okay, we could just as easily, it turns out it's just the same, we could also put a number 1/2 here and a 1/2 here and a 1 over here. Either way, it doesn't matter. Do any of you know what the ground state energy is? For the harmonic oscillator, what's the size of the ground state energy? 1/2. That's right. So that's the first term in the perturbation expansion. And then there's going to be a term A epsilon plus B epsilon squared plus C epsilon cubed, and so on. And of course, if we're calculating the perturbation expansion for the ground state energy, of course, we would also be calculating the perturbation expansion for the ground state wave function as well, the eigenfunction. And this would have the form psi 0 of x plus epsilon psi 1 of x and epsilon squared psi 2 of x, and so on, like that. And can you tell me what is psi 0 of x? Or at least, what is its general structure? It's going to be an exponential of x squared. That's right. So it's going to be e to the minus x squared over, and now tip over 2. But that doesn't matter. There's some function, and so on. So we could do this calculation, and I'm going to show you how to do it in general. in a little while. Okay, we could do such a calculation. And if you were to do the perturbation, if you were to get busy, if you were to hire a high school student, because that's all you need, this is very, very easy to do, you would find that A, the number A, is 3/4. You would find that B is -21/8, and C happens to be 333/16, and so on. Okay? And if you look at those numbers, what do you see? They seem to be getting bigger. Okay? Are we surprised that they're getting bigger? No, we're not, because we expect this to be a singular perturbation problem. If you calculate epsilon, if you calculate the coefficient of epsilon to the 75, it turns out to be about 10 to the 144, something like that. And you can see that something bad is happening here. Okay. In fact, the nth term, if you look at the coefficient of epsilon to the n, as n goes to infinity, the nth term in this perturbation expansion is getting very big. In fact, the nth term is approximately 3 to the n times n factorial. Okay, so this is roughly -1 to the n plus 1, it's alternating in sign, times 3 to the n times n factorial, roughly. What is the radius of convergence of this perturbation expansion? 0. So we have a disaster. Do you see this? You see, you took a quantum mechanics course, and you learned how to do perturbation theory. And I'm going to show you how to do perturbation theory for a problem like this very easily. It's a very routine problem. But it appears to be completely worthless, because no matter what value of epsilon you plug in, this is a divergent series. That's the first lesson to be learned. So you were taught, you took a fraudulent course in your undergraduate career, because you were taught how to do perturbation theory, and as you can see, perturbation theory is a disaster, or appears to be a disaster. Okay, that's the first thing. Secondly, you've been taking a course in quantum field theory, and exactly the same thing happens. So for this quantum field theory, you learned that the coefficient of g to the n, you're calling it g here instead of epsilon, coupling constant, right? The coefficient of g to the n turns out to be exactly the same. The coefficient of g to the n, you learned, of course, that the coefficient was infinite, so you had to renormalize the theory to make it finite. But after you do the renormalization process, the coefficient of g to the n is approximately n factorial. Do you know why it's approximately n factorial? Times a constant to the n. Do you know why it's growing like n factorial? Because there are many graphs. That's why. There are, in fact, about n factorial graphs. And the graphs are all adding up. So how big is the term? About n factorial. That's why. So this has nothing to do with renormalization. After you renormalize the theory to make the coefficient of g to the n be a finite number, the series diverges. And you have to learn what to do. Otherwise, what you've been taught in quantum field theory is also worthless. Okay? The question I want to answer today, and this is a very, very interesting point, is why does the perturbation theory diverge? Is there a physical reason for why it has to diverge? The mathematical reason is simply that there are n factorial graphs. That's why. But is there a physical reason that would say to you that the perturbation theory really had to diverge? And I want to show you what that physical reason is. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about this model here. But in fact, what I'm telling you is a generically true thing. It's true for any perturbative calculation in quantum mechanics. Anyone. It's completely general. So why does perturbation theory diverge? Well, you might do the following experiment, a numerical experiment. You might say, fine, if, you know, if this series, the series for E0 of epsilon is a series of the form sum from 0 to infinity, A sub n, epsilon to the n. This is a Taylor series. A Taylor series converges so long as this function is analytic, right? Why does a Taylor series diverge? There is a singularity in the complex epsilon plane. But you notice that the radius of convergence of this series is 0. That means that there must be a singularity at epsilon equals 0 in the complex epsilon plane. Okay? So here, this is the complex epsilon plane, and I claim there is some singularity right at 0. Okay? So let's try to find what the nature of that singularity is. So I'm going to do a numerical experiment. I'm going to solve this equation, this differential equation, numerically. Just pretend that we're solving it numerically. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at what happens to the eigenvalues E as epsilon moves off into the complex plane, and I'm going to try to find that singularity. So let's start over here at a positive value of epsilon, a small positive value of epsilon. For a small positive value of epsilon, the eigenvalues are approximately 1/2, right? Not quite 1/2, but they're near 1/2 if epsilon is very, very small. Okay? And then, and if we just look at the even, let's just look at the even parity eigenvalue. So the next eigenvalue would be 3/2. And the next one would be 5/2, and so on. But if we just look at the even parity eigenvalues, because we know this equation has parity, the next one would not be 3/2, but would be 5/2, and then not 7/2, but 9/2, and so on. Not 11/2, but 13/2, and so on. So here are the eigenvalues. Now, let's move off into the complex plane using our computer. And in fact, let's just rotate around on a circle. We'll just start moving like this around a circle. Okay, we'll just take a trip, a random trip into the complex epsilon plane. So what you will see happen is this. This eigenvalue will move upward and become complex. And this eigenvalue will move downward, and this will move upward, and this will move downward. It's very interesting. Okay? And it turns out that if you go all the way around to 270 degrees, the eigenvalues all wind up right there exactly on the imaginary axis, like this. Okay? Now let's go further. Let's continue rotating around. We will rotate around further, and the eigenvalues will continue their trip. This guy will go this way, this guy will go this way, this guy will go this way, guy will go that way. Okay? Okay? And when we come back, remember we're traveling in a circle, so when we come back to where we started, you might think the eigenvalues would come back to where they started, but they don't. That tells me that there is a, you say it again, louder? Bruh, there's our branch cut. That's right. Your intuition is completely correct. See? It's getting better. Okay. So there is indeed a branch cut. And when you come back, you're on a different sheet of the Riemann surface. Okay? So there's a branch cut here. And you've emerged from the branch cut, and now you're over here. And when you rotate another 270 degrees, okay, which brings you to the point 3 pi, the eigenvalues continue their journey in the complex plane. So this comes down here, and this comes back here, this comes here, and this comes here. And all the eigenvalues are on the negative real axis. So they once again become real, but they all are now real and negative. Okay? So let's keep going. Okay? So let's continue going around like this. Eventually, we're going to hit this branch cut again. Okay? And we're going to come out there's a branch cut here. We're going to come all the way out over here. And by now, we're up at 810 degrees. Okay. And the eigenvalues are now rotating. They've now rotated back. This guy has come back to the imaginary axis. This guy has come back here, and this guy has come back here, and this guy has come back here. So now the eigenvalues are imaginary again. And this is crying out for one more rotation of 270 degrees. We'll come right back to now 6 pi, and it turns out that the eigenvalues all return to their original starting points. Okay, this comes back here. This comes back here. They all have come back to where they started. So we know that there is a three-sheeted Riemann surface. There is a cube root of epsilon singularity. Cube root of epsilon, you say? Wow, that's really strange. Okay? But it's true. There's a cube root of epsilon. But that doesn't explain why the perturbation series is divergent. Why is that? Because, do you remember what happened over here where we were doing a perturbation expansion in fractional powers of epsilon? You might say, great, we should not do a perturbation expansion in powers of epsilon. Apparently, the natural perturbation expansion parameter is epsilon to the 1/3. And we should look for a perturbation series not of this form, but of that form. That seems like the natural thing to do, because now we will no longer have this branch cut. The singularity will be gone, and we should have an analytic function. But if you do this, what you will find is that one term in this perturbation expansion is non-zero, and the next two terms are zero. And the next term is not, okay, next term is non-zero, and the next two terms are zero. So every third term will be there, and that perturbation expansion will reduce back to the original one. So that is not the important singularity. So you say, wait a minute, what is the important? We took a trip in the complex plane, and all we found was a cube root branch point singularity, and that doesn't, that's not the cause, that's not the explanation of why our perturbation series is divergent. Okay? So we have to look harder. So instead of traveling in a circle in the complex epsilon plane, let me tell you where the singularities are. By the way, the emphasis is not one singularity, but an infinite number of singularities. And the question is, we've missed every one. Where are they? We took a trip. I claim there are an infinite number of singularities here, and we never found one. Why not? Because, so let's clean this up a little bit. Okay, I claim that the important singularities are around 270 degrees. Now, there's a branch cut over here, but that doesn't make any difference. Turns out that's not the important singularity. And these singularities occur in pairs. Very interesting. And there are an infinite number of them. Okay, and they actually have a limit point at the origin. So they become denser and denser and denser. And this sequence of singularities becomes infinitely dense at the origin. So the origin is not even an isolated singularity. It's a limit point of an infinite number of singularities. And these singularities are square root singularities. And I happen to know that you began your course, right, this year, talking about complex variables and talking about square root singularities, right? You did. So, ha, OK. And you know that if you have something like the square root of z squared minus 1, there is a branch point at plus 1 and a branch point at minus 1 here. And you can join this by a branch cut. OK, you learned this, right? You did this. Good. OK. So these are square root singularities. And you can join them with branch cuts that look like this. And you notice you can always push around the branch cut. So these branch cuts can be pushed around to make little circular arcs. Why is it that we never saw these singularities? Because we were traveling in a circle. So we never saw any of these little branch cuts. So now I'm going to do something that is truly amazing. Okay, you're going to see what happens. So here is the here's the energy plane, and here are the energies, 1/2, 5/2, 9/2, 13/2, and so on. And I'm going to do the following. I'm going to start over here just as before, but now I'm going to do something really interesting. I'm going to walk around like this until I reach 270 degrees. Okay? And then I'm going to cross one of those square root branch points. And then I'm going to rotate back to where I started. Okay? Now, what happens? Well, you remember, as we rotated around like this, this went up to the imaginary axis, this went down, this went up, this went down. When we take the second part of our trip, we cross this branch cut, what happens is this moves a little bit, 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 a little bit. Okay? Now I'm going to rotate back again. Okay? So when I rotate back again, sorry, not like that. This moves a little bit here, this moves a little bit, this moves a little bit, this moves a little bit. Okay. When I rotate back again, what happens is that this energy level returns to its original position. And this energy level returns to its original position. But the amazing thing is that this energy level returns to that position over there. And this energy level returns to this position over here. So when the energy levels, when you come back to the starting point, two energy levels have changed their identity. This energy level went off as the ground state energy. It moved a little bit, and then when it came back here. So when I crossed this branch cut, two energy levels changed their identity in a continuous fashion. Okay? So this branch point here corresponds to a change of identity of two energy levels. Now, how many of these branch cuts are there? There are an infinite number of them. And each branch cut can be labeled by the nth energy level changing into the mth energy level. So each of these branch cuts can be labeled by two indices, mn, where the nth energy level turns into the mth energy level. And they exchange their identity. This is called level crossing, by the way. Okay. And so what you've seen is that if you vary epsilon, if you allow epsilon to go off into the complex plane, and you cross a branch point, a branch cut, when you come back, two energy levels have changed their identity. So an analytic continuation of the ground state energy could be the fourth energy level. In fact, what I'm telling you, this is a generic result. It's true for any perturbation theory. You can continuously deform from the nth energy level to the mth energy level. And the energy levels are not distinct things. So when you took your elementary quantum mechanics course, you learned that that a Hamiltonian in quantum mechanics has discrete energy levels. And the energy levels are, you know, there's the first energy level and the second energy level, and you learn words like quantum jump, right? You would jump from one energy level to the next. And the world, the quantum world, was discrete the way the classical world was continuous. It isn't true. It's only discrete if you are narrow-minded and insist on keeping epsilon real. But if we want to find out why, what is the nature of the singularity in the complex plane that causes the perturbation theory to have a radius of convergence, that causes the perturbation series to diverge, those singularities have physical meaning. And the meaning of the singularity is that if these are just square root branch points, if you cross that square root branch point, you are on a different sheet of the Riemann surface, and on this different sheet of the Riemann surface, you have continuously changed two eigenvalues. They have interchanged their identities. Okay, this is a completely generic result. So in fact, if you are not narrow-minded and you allow the perturbation parameter epsilon to vary into the complex plane, you can find the singularities that make the perturbation series diverge. And those singularities are precisely where one energy level turns into another energy level. So in fact, it isn't true that the quantum energies can be labeled E sub n. This is really narrow-minded and it's silly. There is only one energy, and it's called E of epsilon. And on the first sheet of the Riemann surface, this is, you know, on the zeroth sheet of the Riemann surface, E of epsilon has the value E0 of epsilon. And on the second sheet of the Riemann surface, E of epsilon has the value E1 of epsilon. So there's a correspondence between sheets of a Riemann surface, the counting of sheets in a Riemann surface, and the counting of the eigenvalues. So why is there quantization? Because there are different sheets of a Riemann surface. Okay, there's a one-to-one correspondence, a geometrical correspondence, between sheets of a Riemann surface and the count of the eigenvalues. And you can go from any one energy level continuously to any other energy level by just moving around the Riemann surface. So if you imagine, you know, if you're in a parking garage, you can drive around continuously, smoothly, from level to level to level, and the car never feels a bump. But you're going from the first energy level to the second energy level to the third energy level. Okay, there's never a bump. This is a continuous deformation. Why do we think the world is quantized? Because we are completely narrow-minded. Because we think this coupling constant, say G in a quantum field theory, is a real number. And indeed, if you take a parking garage and take a slice through the parking garage, what do you see? You see the different levels in the parking garage, okay? And you think the parking garage is quantized. But it isn't quantized, it's continuous, because you can drive around continuously from one energy level to the next. Okay? Yeah?
So can we devise an experiment with a quantum system
where the epsilon parameter is a complex number and
maybe,
I just see this?
Maybe, and this would be fantastic. And people are thinking about this, okay? And this would be really, really interesting. It would be very non-trivial. I mean, right. You know, an experimentalist can twiddle in, you know,
in quantum electrodynamics, the thing that plays the role of G is alpha. Okay, which is 1 over 137. And the question is, can we adjust, you know, can we twiddle a dial on an experimental apparatus and change the charge on the electron? Well, probably not. But there are, I think, experimental consequences, but they will be indirect experimental consequences. But one way of thinking about this is as follows. You know, when the muon was discovered, there is this very famous comment. So let me ask you, who made the comment, and what was the comment? Very good. Yes, who said that? Do you know? It was Isidore Rabi, who's a professor at Columbia. And when Rabi, so they were looking for the pion. They thought they would find the pion because Yukawa had predicted the pion, okay, which is a strongly interacting particle. But instead, they found something completely different. Roughly at the mass that was predicted for the pion, but not at the right mass. But it was a muon, which is nothing but a heavy version of an electron. But now we understand what the muon is. It's an analytic continuation of the electron. Okay, if you could vary alpha and go off into the complex plane and cross the branch cut and come back to the correct value of alpha, 1 over 137, the analytic continuation of the electron would be a muon. And if you continue that, you would get a tau. And of course, what we don't know is whether or not that's all. Those are the three families of electrons, right? You've studied a little bit the standard model, right? You know there's an electron and a heavy version of an electron called the muon, and a heavier version called the tau, okay? And the electron, the mu, and the tau form a family, are there more? Well, no one has found one yet. If that's true, it's only a three-sheeted Riemann surface. Okay, we don't know. So what perturbation theory tells us is that, so what we learn from this is that the divergence of perturbation theory is not a random thing. It's not as if, you know, something silly happens off in the complex plane to produce a singularity that makes the perturbation theory diverge. When we're talking about a physical problem, what we are seeing is one energy level turning into another energy level. That's the lesson to be learned from this. Okay? Okay, now you had a question. Yeah.
So you have infinitely many of those degeneracies, so like if you start off in the ground state, how do you know which one you're going to have to cross?
You don't. You don't. You actually have to. You have to do. You have to actually. You know. You have to take. You have to do a numerical calculation. Okay. You could also do some very delicate analytical calculations. I don't know if we're going to be able to do that in this course. But you what you do is you vary epsilon very carefully, and then you watch this move, and then it crosses right somewhere over here. And then it either comes back or it comes back here.
If it comes back to its original position, then we know there wasn't a branch cut there. Or possibly this could go up here and maybe go all the way back down to here. Yeah, and then there's I can show you some pictures, and it's very complicated. In fact, I have. These crossing pictures, and maybe I'll show them to you next time. Okay, and when you look at the pictures, it can be a very, very complicated. I drew it here as a schematic picture, but it actually can be quite complicated, quite complex.
Can you also see what happens?
Exactly the same thing happens. Okay, the odd eigenvalues, the same thing happens, but the odd eigenvalues cannot come back as even eigenvalues. Right. And why is there this separation? Because this Hamiltonian happens to have a strict symmetry that separates the odd parity eigenvalues from the even parity eigenvalues. So if we have a strict symmetry, we can't break that symmetry. You can't have an odd parity eigenvalue analytically continuing to an even parity eigenvalue. That would violate parity.
There's the same branch cut that takes even.
No, there's a different set of branch cuts.
So each eigenvalue has its own. For the even parity eigenvalues, there's this bunch of herringbone set of infinite herringbone set of branch cuts, and for the odd parity, there's a similar structure here, centered at 270 degrees, but they're not in the same positions. Not numerically in the same positions, so the odd ones and the even ones are numerically different. Okay. Okay. So the point that I'm making here is that this result is completely generic. In fact, the picture that I've given you. So, what is the bottom line from what I've said today, is that if you wish to solve a Schrödinger eigenvalue problem like this, and you can't solve this problem. This is a very, very hard problem. And you decide to solve this problem by introducing, say, an epsilon over here. Then typically, this perturbation series, This may be a regular perturbation series, or it may be a singular perturbation series, but it doesn't make any difference at all. The question is, what is it that makes the perturbation series diverge if the perturbation series is going to diverge, you know, at the point where the series diverges? By the way, can you think of an example here where this might be a convergent perturbation series? Come up with an example? What, I mean, you know, where what would the potential have to be? What would that potential W have to be here in order for this to be a regular perturbation series? X, for example. Because now this argument fails. This is no longer true. Or maybe absolute X or something like that. You know, just some potential where this is less big than this at infinity. So we don't have this effect of turning over and having tunneling occur and losing the ground state energy and so on. Okay? So in this case, the perturbation expansion has a non-zero radius of convergence because it is a regular perturbation expansion. But what is it that causes it to have even a finite, non-zero radius of convergence? Singularities just like this, where energy levels, where you see energy level crossing. And this is a completely generic result. It has nothing to do with this particular model that I started out talking about. It's true for any case. In fact, what we will talk about next time, I just want to show you what we're going to talk about next time, is the simplest possible example. The simplest possible example would be an eigenvalue problem, which is just a matrix eigenvalue problem. We can get back down to polynomials. Okay? So suppose my Hamiltonian was A, B, 0, 0. So there are two states of this Hamiltonian. This is just a very simple quantum system. There are two states. The energy levels are A and B. But let's make this into a, quote, hard problem. Now, this really isn't a hard problem, but I'm going to make the problem a little bit more complicated by turning on an interaction between those two states. So this could be a spin-up electron and a spin-down electron, maybe. And now the spin-up electron and the spin-down electron are coupled to some external field, and now the spin can flip. Okay? And we'll pretend this is a very hard problem. So we have to solve this perturbatively. So how will we solve it perturbatively? We'll put an epsilon in front of W. Okay? And this is a typical problem that we could solve perturbatively. And I'm going to show you next time explicitly that this perturbation series, this is a regular perturbation problem because nothing abrupt happens at epsilon equals 0. But I'm going to show you that the thing that causes this perturbation series to diverge is level crossing, where the first energy level becomes the second energy level becomes the first energy level. Okay, one level turns into the other. They exchange identities. So this is really cool. Okay? Yeah.
So the example where the perturbation is the absolute value of x, mm-hmm. you said that has a finite radius of convergence. And so in that case, I guess the singularity structure is just different. There is nothing.
No, the singularity structure is roughly the same, except that this sequence of square type branch points stops.
Right, that's what I think.
It just stops. So you have a sequence of branch cuts,
right.
But they don't come closer than a certain distance to the origin. Right. And that is, in fact, precisely what happens in this problem.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
In a like macroscopic classical system, you still get differential equations governing it, and you can still expand it perturbatively, and they still diverge sometimes. So why don't we get quantization of classical systems?
Well, no, wait a minute. you're saying it backwards, okay? The question is, can we have... This shows that the discrete energy levels in the quantum system correspond to the fact that we only look at the quantum system for some fixed value of epsilon, and we don't allow epsilon to vary into the complex plane to try to understand why the perturbation series is diverging. So when we introduce a parameter into the problem, we have extended one problem to an infinite class of problems characterized by epsilon. And what we find is that the discrete energy levels considered as a function of epsilon are no longer discrete. If we can vary epsilon physically, there's really only one energy function, and it's continuous. But the reverse is not true. If we have a classical system, and you want to introduce a parameter to study the classical system, that isn't going to quantize it. Okay, that's a different effect. Okay, here we're studying an infinite class of classical systems parametrized by some value, some parameter epsilon. But that doesn't make the energies become quantized. Okay, what I am saying is that a quantum system, in fact, behaves much more classically, much more smoothly than you might have thought. Okay, and if you consider it as a function of epsilon, the quantization of the system goes away. Things are smooth and continuous. And you could travel from one energy level to the other in a perfectly smooth and continuous fashion. Nothing abrupt happens. As a function of epsilon, which is quite remarkable. And again, why is the world quantized? It is quantized because there's a one-to-one correspondence between sheets in a Riemann surface in the complex epsilon plane and the numbering of energy levels, E1, E2, E3, and so on. That's why we have quantization. Quantization is a purely geometric phenomenon. How do we see quantization? We take this infinite smooth parking garage in the epsilon plane and take a slice through it, and you see the energy levels. It looks like there are discrete energy levels. But they're not independent functions of epsilon. They're all branches of one function called the energy function, E of epsilon. That's the lesson. The perturbation theory is revealing a fantastic amount of depth about the nature of a physical theory, the mathematical structure of a physical theory. Okay. Okay. Any? Have I blown you away, or do you find this interesting? Okay. So next time we should become a little bit more mundane. We'll work out a model, and you'll see this happening. You'll actually see that it actually happens. What I'm telling you is not a joke. This is real. Okay? Yeah.
Why is it that the
I think you're trying to say, how can we know that the complex plane is there?
Well, actually, I think it's the opposite way.
Let's talk some more about it.
I mean, this is not, you're asking a hard question about the connection between, you know, what experiments can we perform to observe the effects that I'm talking about, I think that's what you want to know. And that's a hard question. This is not trivial. Well, the world is, I guess we would say the world is real because if you believe that it is described by, say, a quantum field theory like this, it's real because this coupling constant is a real number. It's measured to be a real number. And we don't have the ability to change the value of this complex, of this coupling constant to make it complex. We may not, as experimentalists, be able to stand in front of our equipment and turn a dial and make you know, just the way we can vary a voltage in a power supply, we may not be able to vary that coupling constant and make it complex. So what we're going to have to do to see, I mean, of course, mathematically, we're theorists. So we can make it complex. We can say, let's take G to be equal to 1 plus 3i. Okay, but that's just a mathematical experiment. In a physical experiment, we can't do that. However, we may be able to make inferences based on that. And that would be very interesting. And they're physically, these structures, these complex structures, these branch cuts, are there in the complex epsilon plane. So the answer is two words. Okay, yeah. So the answer to that question is in two words. Analytic continuation. Okay. Have you talked about analytic continuation?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So the point is, if you know a function on the real axis and the function is analytic, you know it everywhere in the complex plane.
Yes.
Okay. So what happens in the complex plane is connected to what's happening on the real axis. So although we live in the real world, I think we live in the real world. I mean, sometimes when I look at my world, it's very complex. But, you know, when we live in the real world, but what is happening in the complex world does affect what we measure to be true in the real world. Okay? And that is, I mean, this is a very subtle point. I think I'll just make one comment about it. And that is that a lot of people feel and have felt that analyticity is a very, very physical phenomenon. Okay? And there is there's a lot of work called that was being done as early as the 1950s when field theory was being developed called analytic basically analytic S matrix theory, okay? I don't want to go too deep into it, but people were studying things like Reggie theory and analytic matrix theory, and it was believed that the world was described by Green's functions, correlation functions, which are analytic functions, and that if we could understand their properties in the complex plane, that we could understand what we were observing in the real world in which we live, okay? And that is not necessary. I mean, I actually like that picture. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful picture about the connection between physics and mathematics. But it's what you're asking is a very deep question about this, about analytic matrix theory and analytic S matrix theory and so on. And I will tell you a little more about it next time. But this is basically not well understood, and I think definitely worthy of further investigation and examination and deep thought and so on. Yeah. I'm going to show you that. Oh wait, how do I? Yeah, there's a singularity here.
No, but you don't cross, you don't cross any branch cuts between say X1.
When I go in a circle.
No, when you just go, on the real line.
Oh, there are no branch cuts on the real line. That's right.
But the
thing that determines the radius of convergence of a Taylor series, their singularities, those singularities don't have to be on the real line. They can be in anywhere in the complex plane. So if this is the complex, if you have a function f of z, and this is the complex f of z plane, and you have a Taylor series, you expand f of z into a Taylor series.
No, I understand, but you
okay,
said, you
so
said,
there could be a singularity over there, yeah. And that says that this is the circular region in which that Taylor series, inside of which the Taylor series converges. Okay? So this singularity corresponds to, say, this singularity.
But you said that, you saw a problem when you took epsilon going on the real axis.
When I took epsilon?
From positive to negative.
No. That was the thing. That wasn't a singularity. Now I understand your question. Yeah, that just tells me that I have a singular perturbation expansion. That is not saying that there is a singularity. That is merely saying that something abrupt happened at epsilon equals zero. And therefore, we are dealing with a singular perturbation problem. And if we have a singular perturbation problem, this is what it means.
It means that it is not likely for the perturbation series to have the form of a Taylor series. And if it does have the form of a Taylor series, a formal Taylor series, it will have a zero radius of convergence. That's what it says. Okay.
Okay, so can you go backwards and say that I see all my branches, I'd say my function epsilon, A of epsilon.
Yeah.
And so now can I conclude from that it's a singular perturbation theory?
You mean if I hadn't done the first argument?
Yeah.
The answer is yes,
if these singularities have a limit point right at the origin, giving the radius of convergence of the Taylor series as zero. So all these branch points come arbitrarily close to the origin. They have a limit point at the origin. So that means the radius of convergence of a perturbation series is zero. So then I know from that I must be talking about, even if I didn't make that argument about the ground state becoming unstable, I know that I must be talking about a singular perturbation problem. Okay, because my perturbation series simply doesn't converge. Okay. Of course, you understand what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to motivate this course. I'm trying to motivate you to listen, because I'm trying to show you that if you just blindly do perturbation theory, which is straightforward and easy bookkeeping work, you end up typically with a series that doesn't converge. And that looks like you've wasted your time. And what I'm going to show you is you haven't. It's wonderful, because we're going to learn how to sum a divergent series and get the right answer, which is amazing in itself, just mathematically. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there. Okay. Yeah.